City. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. You can watch today's program by going to GaryNull.com or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. A special hello to our audience listening on WPFW, WPAI, KPFK, and all the other stations around the United States and people throughout the world. Today, no guest. I'm going to lead off, of course, as I do every day, with the latest state-of-the-art in health and healing, anti-aging. I'll give an environmental update. But then, because of what is happening in the Middle East, I felt it was important to offer a progressive commentary, an insight. I will be sharing my own thoughts that I wrote last night, commentary from Chris Hedges from TruthDig.com, insights from Targeting Civilians, Israeli Specialty from Stephen Ledman, Global Research, and David Harris Gerson, Israel Minister, the goal is to send Gaza back to the Middle Ages. I will then offer this audience of critical thinkers an opportunity to call in and share your points of view. We'll get to that in a little bit. But first, last week we had an opportunity to help raise money for the Pacific Archives, which was very successful. And also, most importantly, one day last week, from 6 in the morning till 6 in the evening, all the different Pacifica stations and some additional independent stations took time to raise money for our sister station, WBAI, which was desperately needed because Hurricane Sandy interrupted their marathon. So the good news was that we raised a record amount of money, $185,000, during that short period of time. So that made up the difference, and literally, since we were averaging about $20,000 a day in the normal drive, that was equivalent to what we would have raised in 2 weeks. So that helped us. Now, hopefully, we can get back to regular scheduled programming. And that was due in no small measure because of the executive director of Pacifica, Summer Reese, who simply said, we're going to do it, and then got the station managers, including Andrew Phillips, who used to be the program director at WBAI in New York, and in my opinion was one of the finest program directors in this history, and all the other station managers to agree. It was one of those rare moments of cooperation. Wouldn't have happened without her, so we have to say a special thank you to her. Now, let us go to, and by the way, I realize many of you were tuning in each day to some of these stations and weren't able to hear my show because it had been preempted. Let me explain what happens. 13 hours a week, I do live broadcasting. Every single day I'm broadcasting, then on Sunday evenings and on Monday evenings. And this originates from our studio here, the Progressive Radio Network. If you should ever tune on your local station and not hear me, there's a simple solution. Please write this down. You can use your telephone and call in and hear me live. That number is 832-280-0066. 832-280-0066. Or you can always go to PRN, and if I'm on the air, you're going to hear me, even if other stations may be preempting me for legitimate reasons, and certainly ones I support. So this way, you don't have to say, where's Gary? He's just either a phone call away, or he's a click on the internet away. Let us begin now. A lot of people don't like beans. I understand they feel that sometimes it makes them a little gaseous. And indeed, if beans are not cooked correctly, that is the case. The proper way to cook beans is in a pressure cooker, but first the key is soaking them overnight and allowing about a tablespoon per gallon of apple cider vinegar. And that helps to release a lot of the chemicals in the bean that once cooked would create some of the gas. Also, a lot of the gas when eating beans occurs when we miscombine food. What does that mean? It means if you eat something that requires very little digestion, like a piece of fruit. With beans, the beans take longer to digest. The fruit takes almost no time to digest. And simple carbohydrates take no time to digest. So when you have something that requires a lot of digestion, and the most digestion time is spent with fats. So if you were to eat, butter, or something with lard, or meat, like pork, that's going to take hours to get out of your stomach. Now, if you have beans at the same time, they won't take that much time. So now you create a highly acidic condition, and that can promote gas. But otherwise, there's no reason not to have beans. Let me tell you why beans, in my opinion, are right up there with the fruits and vegetables as far as what we need on a daily basis. First, as an athlete, as a competing athlete, my entire life, I don't eat animal proteins. So where do I get my strength and how do I replenish my muscle tissue? Amino acids. Now here's one of the simplest lessons to learn, yet it's been one of the best lies ever, that only animal proteins, such as dairy, milk and cheese and yogurt, or fish or chicken, veal, lamb, beef, pork, those are the only foods, along with the egg, that provide you with your complete amino acids that you need if you want to keep a good muscle mass, if you want to be strong and healthy and virile. But it's a lie. It's always been a lie. And how do I know this? Because I did the original research at the Institute of Plant Biology that showed that brown rice had all 8 essential amino acids, meaning our body can't produce those internally, synthesize them. We have to bring them into our body. You have to eat them. I grew up believing, as did everyone else I knew, that you should have animal proteins 3 times a day. So what I did is I drank milk 3 times a day. When I look at photographs of myself when I was a teenager, I had puffiness under my eyes. I had lines underneath my eyes. I had congestion. When I gave up the dairy, I no longer did. I gave you half the story of what happened when this little slight guy came by a gym where a bunch of us were powerlifters. We didn't do bodybuilding. We did weightlifting, powerlifting. You know, you pride yourself on how much you can deadlift, 450 pounds, a clean and jerk, a bench press, curl, etc. This little guy was able to do more than all of us. Not in the amount of weight that he lifted, but in the amount of sit-ups he could do. And then he asked us to lift him off the ground, and we couldn't. And everyone thought someone else was playing a joke, but no one could lift him off. And later he said to me, I said, "What just happened?" He said he was a vegan, and he had studied Oriental philosophy, and he had studied the chi, the vital life force. And once you understand the power of your mind to impact your chi, that you use that energy in ways that are constructive. And all he did was ground his chi to make our efforts in vain. I didn't understand it at that time, but I saw it. I experienced it. So I knew that there was a reality beyond my conditioning. So when he said he was a vegan, I said, "What's that? What's a vegan?" And he said, "A person that doesn't have any animal proteins." And he told me what he ate. I'd never heard of tofu. Mind you, I'm from West Virginia, where the tallest building, I think there were 2 that were 7 stories, and a big city was Pittsburgh, and almost no one ever got there. So you heard stories about being in the big cities. We were small town people. Just regular, good, middle-class people, working people. So when this guy was talking about something from the Orient and being a vegan and eating tofu and miso soup and green tea, I was clueless about what he was talking about. But a year later, I wasn't. because when I got to New York and I gave up dairy and I began to do what was my first detox, I then started to see the first thing happened is all the puffiness underneath my eyes went away. My head congestion went away. My body began to slim down, and I got stronger and faster. My reflexes were faster than they had been before. So this was a catharsis for me. I was very open to all insights. I didn't come with any prepackaged conditioned beliefs that I couldn't step over a line, because that was forbidden territory to learn from. So there was no political, religious, social, or ideological, cultural, or ethnic barriers to me. Wherever the truth was, I was open to it. It was that simple. I can thank my mother for that, because she once told me, she says, a lot of the people in this town are very prejudiced. They're good people in their own way, but they live by superstition. They're very prejudiced. So don't let their prejudice limit your insights. I was too young to fully appreciate it. When I came to New York and saw a much more broad-based and more progressive community, I really enjoyed that interchange. And that was far more important to me than being dirt poor and not having anything physically to show for why I was being here, because I had far more than something physical. I had the dynamic interrelationships of people. Well, that said, there were a lot of people interested in detoxing and cleansing and vegetarianism at that time. Far more people at that time than today. I mean, there were organic movements. It was a part of liberating yourself from the traditional American diet, liberating yourself from not being active physically. Yoga was a liberation. Meditation was a liberation. And so when I looked at all this and I started to realize, gee whiz, you know, why are we still living with these myths? One of the very first myths I look at was the protein in the American diet. And then I just did this reasoning. Why is it that those creatures on the planet that eat the most protein from animals die the fastest? Most, not all. And the shark is one of the exceptions. But the turtle, that's the longest-lived creature on Earth. And then the elephant can live 100 years. And so I started to realize maybe we had gotten it wrong. And that's when I began to do the research, and I found out that what we really need are amino acids, the building blocks protein. And the amino acids like lysine or tryptophan or methionine or isoleucine, whether or not these come from brown rice or beans or an egg or a steak, they're all the same in the body. It's the source that made the difference. So once I discovered and had it replicated for almost a year that all vegetables and all nuts and seeds and legumes and fruits contain all 8 essential amino acids, and there was no longer ever any idea that you had to have dairy, or you had to have non-fat dry milk, or you had to have whey protein, or you had to have fish in order to get all your amino acids. You didn't. You simply had to have a good balance from a variety of sources so that you got a full spread of the amino acids. So whatever might be limited in one was made up and compensated another. For example, what you're limited in rice, you make up in beans. So by having rice and beans together, you have protein equal and surpassing that of meat, fish, chicken, dairy. But also you get something else. You get all the B complex. You get fiber. You get the polyphenols. You get phytonutrients. You do not get that in meat. You get some B vitamins, meat, and iron, but you don't get anything else. It's dead matter. So now we take a look at those cultures that have lived where beans have been an important part of their life. And then we start to understand, well, gee whiz, beans are a great source of protein. I mean, one serving of soybeans is almost one half of a person's entire protein requirements for a day. And we don't think about that. Somehow friends say, gee, where are you getting your protein? You going to die? You going to be a little puny? Well, do I look puny? No. In fact, I've just... 2 weeks ago, I took some new photographs in the same pose that I did over the last 30 years. And I put them aside. Every year I do this because I want to know for myself, where am I aging? And I did the same identical photographs. I took a 20 years worth of span. It's up on the website. You can see it under Gary Nall Com, then go to photographs. In the very first bar, you'll see four photographs. Well, the latest one was just taken 2 weeks ago Saturday. And you tell me, when you look at that, what's different than 20 years ago? The only difference is I was 195 20 years ago and 180 when that picture was taken. Outside of that, no difference in muscle, skin, proportion of body weight, muscle on the body. And that shows that over 20 years when I should have been aging, I wasn't. Well, if I don't have to age, then no one has to age. So the idea is if I use myself as a human laboratory and a guinea pig and try things, some work, some don't, well, then that means that I'm going to share that with you. So you should start doing the same. I'm going to encourage everyone who wants to try this to do this. Get in a bathing suit or shorts and just take a picture of yourself in whatever pose you feel comfortable in that you can see the body. And then date it. But get a close-up so that you can see your hairline, the color of your hair, your skin, the texture of your skin, the musculature on your legs, your arms, your abdomen, your chest. And then every 12 months, take another photograph and have your own, you know, your own time-lapse photography of your own aging process. If you're the average person, you see a real big arc up from where you start to where you really, graying hair, thinning of the skin, more veins, varicosities, purple veins in the feet and the legs, lowering of the gluteus maximus, your butt starts to drop, your chest starts to drop, your skin becomes flabby and becomes wrinkled, your neck gets loose, you get jowly, the fat tissue in the upper part of your cheek starts to sag down, so you get that kind of hound dog look. If you saw that and you realize how fast you're aging, wouldn't you then want to do something to reverse it, to slow it down? And you can. But what if each year you didn't see any of that? To the contrary, you actually look younger. That is what one-on-one we have to do. In effect, you become your own scientific experiment. And each of us are uniquely different. We can't all eat the same foods in the same amounts. We're not all going to be able to take the same supplements, the same amounts. If you drank the amount of wheatgrass juice that I do each day, you'd barf. You'd just projectile right out. And someone actually did not long ago. I was standing at a juice bar and this guy says, "Hey, what do you got there?" I said, "A green juice." I said, "No, it's wheatgrass juice." He said, "Give me one of those." I said, "Fella, I wouldn't try that. Take a small amount. Start with 2 ounces. Ah, you can do it, I can." I said, "But I have a tolerance for it. I've built this up." I said, "If I drank this amount that I am now 20 years ago, I'd have thrown it up." "Oh, but it's not going to happen." So he did. And about, you could see it. You could see it in his face after he drank it down. He turned to me. He looked at me. He went green and boom, out it came. Tough lesson to learn. You have to gradually build up. And that's true of most things. When I give someone a protocol, I don't say, take this amount, and this amount. I say, this is the ideal you want to reach, but let's do it over a six-month period. Start at the lowest amount so your body develops a tolerance, then a little higher, then a little higher, and a little higher. Same way with juicing. First week, first month, you take one glass of juice a day. The second month, you take two glasses a day. So anyhow, the same is true for eating like a vegetarian, eating things you haven't eaten before, so your body develops a tolerance for it, develops a memory. Mind you, every single thing that you eat or drink, your body will remember. There is a memory, just like a wonderful hug. We all like to be hugged, and those hugs remind us of when we were hugged and loved at some point in our life. Every cell then remembers that. That becomes a good memory, just as someone yelling at us or someone demeaning us or someone betraying us or someone harassing us or someone writing us bad emails or letters or leaving toxic messages. That also creates a memory. They're both real. They're energy patterns. Then we take these in, and then, unfortunately, we, more often than not in our society, we have more of the negative experiences that we remember than the positives. So when you eat good things, and you develop an idea of how it smells, how it looks, how it tastes, how the aftertaste, how you feel afterwards, all that is reconditioning your body and your mind to make this a normal part. So then you can walk right by a hot dog stand or a pizza place and not think twice about, oh my goodness, I got to run in there and get that. This smells so good. I got to just have it. No, you don't, because you've reconditioned yourself. Anyhow, I'm just giving this as an extended understanding that when we start eating more beans, get out of the mindset that, well, I don't like them because they cause gas or they regurgitate. Then have those beans out of a can, because canned beans have already gone through that process, so they're the easiest beans to digest. Later, you can end up soaking them overnight and then pressure cooking them so you won't have that. Then do bean dips like hummus. That's from garbanzo beans, which is a very nutritious bean, and it's easy to digest. It's loaded with phytonutrients. It's a healing functional food. It's a common staple in the Middle East. And by adding garlic and chives and onion and lemon to it and pepper, you really make it beneficial, dropping the blood sugar, helping cholesterol, cleansing out the intestines. And hummus does all that. But it starts off as an old bean. Garbanzo bean was one of the very first beans cultivated. It's one of those historical beans. We just don't eat them in the United States. And we should. Here's the latest research out of Japan. It was a 7-year study. They studied 43,000 people between the ages of 40 and 80 that had high cancer rates and ate little fiber. The more fiber they got from beans, however, the lower the risk of colon cancer, especially in men. And it is the bean fiber that impacted the colon cancer statistics more than any other source of fiber. And other research indicate that fiber beans like garbanzo actually keep your body from absorbing carcinogens. So when you take in fewer carcinogens, the less damage is done to the cells and the tissues and your organs. And the less damage equates to a lower cancer risk in the long run. And beans contain what are called phyto chemicals. These are naturally occurring cancer-fighting and free radical-fighting nutrients. And the phytochemicals neutralize free radicals before they damage your cells. Greek researchers tested extracts from 11 different legumes. By the way, beans are legumes. And found that all of them neutralize free radicals. And they help protect the DNA from oxidative damage. And they had anti-cancer potential. And what about beans helping women thwart breast cancer? Now, here's something brand new that you haven't heard. In a study of 90,000 young nurses, the nurses who ate beans or lentils twice a week were less likely to develop breast cancer. And the experts assumed that the flavanols, again, phytonutrients, block the free radicals, prevent oxidative damage to the cells, and encourage cancer cells to die, apoptosis, programmed cell death. All you have to do is work at 2 servings of beans or lentils per week. That's minimum. I suggest that you have 1 serving of bean per day. That's the best way. And by the way, refried beans are also good. That's very tasty. And it's also a way of cutting down on your carbs because they're low in sugars and therefore great for you. Pinto beans, kidney, navy, white, black, garbanzo, lima beans all help reduce your likelihood of having colon cancer. And another weapon against cancer is the folate found in B vitamins, which beans are a great source of folate. And eating high folate foods reduces the risk of pancreatic and colon cancer. And folate helps fill up the repair of DNA. Too little leads to DNA damage, so you need folate. And so if you're diabetic, beans are just phenomenal for you. Pre-diabetic, great also. Help you prevent from becoming diabetic. So those are just the latest issues on health. Now, tomorrow I'll do more on health, but I want to spend more time today on the issue at hand. But before we go to our break, and I come back with my commentary and other commentaries, this was sent to me from a person from Yellowstone Park. Let me read it. Social Security is now called federal benefit payment, which is an entitlement. Have you noticed your Social Security check is now referred to as a federal benefit payment? Please keep this in mind. The government is now referring to our Social Security checks as federal benefit payment. This isn't a benefit. It's earned income. Not only did we all contribute to Social Security, but our employers did too. It totaled 15% of our income before taxes. If you average $30,000 per year over your working life, that's close to $180,000 invested in Social Security. If you calculate the future value of your monthly investment in Social Security, it's $375 a month, including both your and your employer contributions, at a meager 1% interest rate, compounded monthly. After 40 years of working, you have more than $1,300,000 saved. This is your personal investment. Upon retirement, if you took out only 3% per year, you'd receive $39,318 per year, or $3,277 per month. That's almost three times more than today's average Social Security benefit of $1,230 per month, according to the Social Security Administration. And your retirement fund would last approximately 33 years, or until you're about 98, if you retire at 65. I can only imagine how much better most average income people could live in retirement if our government had just invested our money in low-risk interest-earning accounts. Instead, the folks in Washington pulled off a bigger Ponzi scheme than Bernie Madoff ever did. They took our money and used it elsewhere. They forgot that it's our money they're taking. They didn't have a referendum to ask us if we wanted to lend them our money, and they didn't pay interest on the debt they assumed. And recently they've told us that the money won't support us for very much longer. But it's somehow our fault they misused our investments. And now, to add insult to injury, they're calling it a benefit, as if we never worked to earn every penny of it. Just because they borrowed the money doesn't mean that our investments were a charity. We have earned our right to Social Security and Medicare. Demand that our legislators bring some sense to our government. Find a way to keep Social Security and Medicare going for the sake of all of us. It's our money. It's not an entitlement. I absolutely agree with those opinions, and thank you, whoever you are, for sending them. I'm Gary Nall. Let me first give you some program announcements, and then we'll come back in the rest of our show. Half hour will be devoted to the issue of the day. Tomorrow, I'm going to be filming in Red Bank in New Jersey. We need one last interview to complete a major important film. If you are able to accommodate my crew, myself, we could use a driver. You can call Richard Gale, our producer, at 646-926-5436. 646-926-5436, because I'm going to be filming over there tomorrow. Very important. Tonight at 7 p.m. on the Progressive Commentary Hour, a hard-hitting show. The many ways government has increased surveillance of all of us, all American citizens. My guest, Media Benjamin, co-founder of the anti-war feminist organization Code Pink, and a co-founder of the international human rights organization Global Exchange. Chase Madar, an attorney in New York and a member of the National Lawyers Guild and a public interest association of lawyers dedicated to progressive change in our legal and political system. Hani Fakhouri, staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who writes and lectures on the technology and criminal law and privacy and free speech. You won't want to miss that. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. to have you with us, everyone. By the way, it's Media Benjamin, not Media Benjamin. Now for a series of commentaries. I am concerned when the President of the United States, speaking on behalf of the federal government and much of the American public, and certainly the majority of the American media, suggests that the airstrikes into Gaza are a legitimate form of self-defense. I'm also concerned that virtually all the American media starts off with the idea that Israel is the victim, and therefore its response is a legitimately measured response. It is neither. What is not told is that we have never had the mainstream American media take time to actually embed themselves in the life in a day, in a week or a month, of people living in Gaza or the West Bank. Hence, the American public does not know the historical suffering, the long suffering of people, irrespective of those who are not of a peaceful persuasion, which are the tiny minority in that area of the world. Let us look at it from a historical point of view and then put a face on it the American people never see. We're talking about a small area with 1.6 million residents. 80% of those people are refugees. Therefore, there is actually a dysphoria. Noam Chomsky recently visited Gaza. He said Gaza is the world's, quote, largest open-air prison. There has been 5 years now of Israeli blockades on Gaza. UN investigators and human rights observers and organizations and some national governments have accused Israel of apartheid against Palestinians. Please remember, every single administration, every single Congress supported apartheid and our positions toward apartheid, our trading with apartheid companies and its government, until it was over, much like we supported virtually all the dictatorships and all of the corrupt regimes in the Middle East. All of them we supported until the Arab Spring. We not only supported them with military, but also by sending many of the individuals who had been captured there to be tortured. It was called rendering. So it is not a rare occasion when we're on the wrong side of history. The crime of apartheid was defined a decade ago by the Roman statute of the International Criminal Court. It said, quote, inhumane acts of a character similar to other crimes against humanity that are committed in the context of an institutionalized regime, meaning Israel, of systemic oppression and domination of one racial group over another racial group or groups and committed in with the intention of maintaining that regime, end quote. So there is no question at all on the legal front that Israel has engaged in apartheid. From sources, including Middle East Institute of Middle East, an independent think tank, 54% of households right now and have historically had food insecurity. That means inadequate physical, social, and economic access to food. 12% are considered vulnerable to food insecurity. Only 20% of Gazian households are food secure. 30% of the population lives below the poverty line. And since the blockade began, the number of Palestinian refugees completely unable to secure access to food and lacking the means to purchase even the most basic items, such as soap and school stationery and safe drinking water, means they are in abject poverty. That has tripled to 300,000 people. 75% of the households polled by the World Food Program and the Gaza Strip received outside aid. Gaza's hospitals are at zero stock levels for 178 of 480 essential medications, with another 69 at low stock. Of 700 essential medical supplies, 180 are at zero, meaning they're out of them completely. Also, due to a lack of fuel, the Gaza power plant runs at 45% capacity, leading to about 12 hours without power per day. And this has gone on for years. Now, given this fuel shortage, 90% of private cars are no longer driven, and public services are diminished, only 15% of any public service is operational. In the Gaza Strip, 95% of the water sources are unfit to drink. Or put another way, imagine after Hurricane Sandy and all those power lines down and all the power plants and purification systems shut down, and we are warned that our water is not fit to drink and must boil it. That is every single day for 95% of the people in Gaza, 1.6 million residents, not for a week, but for years. And because of a lack of treatment capacities and electricity, Gaza authorities must release around 80,000 cubic meters of raw sewage into the Mediterranean every single day. The construction of 86,000 houses is required to meet the natural growth and recovery from previous Israeli invasions. The economic output per capita has fallen 40% since 1994. And thousands upon thousands of businesses, industrial businesses, have closed because they can't get any materials because of the blockade. How did this all happen? Well, you have to take a little trip back in history. Go back to June 1967, the Six-Day War. Israel launches a strike on Egyptian Air Force following Egyptian naval blockade of the Straits of Tyran and Egyptian military buildup in the Sinai Peninsula, interpreted as acts of war. An attack quickly turns into a regional war in which Israel defeats the combined forces of Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, and their supporters. It captures the Sinai Peninsula and the Gaza Strip from Egypt, and East Jerusalem and the West Bank from Jordan, and the Golan Heights from Syria. And then in 1969, Yasser Arafat, head of the Fatah Party, is appointed chairman of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, replacing another individual. And then you have in 1973 the Yom Kippur War, Syria and Egypt surprise attack Israel forces in the Golan Heights and the Sinai Peninsula on the holiest day of the Hebrew calendar, and Jordan, Iraq, and other Arab nations joined in and or supported the Arab war effort. Many Israeli prisoners of war were tortured and killed by Egypt and Syria while in captivity. In September 17, 1978, Begin and Egyptian President Sadat signed the Camp David Accord, with Israel agreeing to withdraw from the Sinai Peninsula in exchange for peace and a framework of future negotiation over the West Bank and Gaza. In March 26, 1979, Israel and Egypt peace treaty is signed. Egypt became the first Arab country to officially recognize Israel. And then in December 8, 1987, the first Intifada begins. Violence, riots, general strikes, and civil disobedience campaigns by Palestinians spread across the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Israeli forces respond with tear gas, bullets, and live ammunition. And after the outbreak of the first Intifada, a Sheikh Ahmad Yassin creates Hamas from the Gaza wing of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. And until this point, the Muslim Brotherhood in Gaza had enjoyed the support of the Israeli authorities and had refrained from violent attacks. However, Hamas quickly began attacking Israel military targets and subsequently Israeli civilians. November 15, 1988, an independent state of Palestine was proclaimed by the Palestinian National Council meeting in Algiers. And then August 20, 1993, Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin signed the Declaration of Principles on Interim Self-Government in Oslo. This event is also seen by many people as the definitive end of the First Intifada. And then on November 4, 1995, Prime Minister Rabin is assassinated in Tel Aviv by a Jewish extremist, a man named Yigal Amir, and Shimon Peres assumes the position of acting Prime Minister. In May of 1996, Benjamin Netanyahu of the Likud is elected prime minister. And each one of these events creates the idea that you have a problem between the Israelis and the Palestinians seeking to have a two-country solution. And what you end up having is you have, no matter what has occurred at the UN, no matter what resolutions are passed, no matter what the Arab League chooses, Israel begins to intensify taking away lands belonging to the Palestinians and settling them. and these are going on at a very escalated rate with no interference from any of American presidents, including the current one. And the original Battle of Gaza started in back in, it was June 7, 2007, the Battle of Gaza, resulting in Hamas taking control of the Gaza Strip from Fatah. And then February 28, 2008, Operation Hot Winter is launched in response to rockets fired from the Gaza Strip into Israel. The occupation resulted in 110 to 12 Palestinians and three Israelis being killed. And then you had it really start to come down. You had November 4, 2008, Israeli troops made a raid on Gaza in which they killed six members of Hamas, hence breaking a ceasefire. Then December 2008, Israel launches Operation Cast Lead against Hamas controlled Gaza. It was a full-scale invasion of the territory. 1,200 Palestinians, the vast majority of them, women and children and civilians, were killed. And then we have what is now. You have to have a context in order to understand the principles. If you don't, then how in the world can we possibly have any understanding what really happened? Gaza is a window on our coming dystopia. The growing divide between the world's elite and its miserable masses of humanity is maintained through spiraling violence. Many impoverished regions of the world, which have fallen off the economic cliff, are beginning to resemble Gaza, where, as I mentioned, 1.6 million Palestinians live in the planet's largest internment camp. These sacrifice zones, filled with seas of pitifully poor people trapped in squalid slums or mud-walled villages, are increasingly hemmed in by electronic fences, monitored by surveillance cameras and drones, and surrounded by border guards or military units that shoot to kill. These nightmarish dystopias extend from sub-Saharan Africa to Pakistan to China. They are places where targeted assassinations are carried out, where brutal military assaults are pressed against peoples left defenseless, without an army, navy, or air force. All attempts at resistance, however ineffective, are met with the indiscriminate slaughter that characterizes modern industrial warfare. In the new global landscape, as in Israel's occupied territories, in the United States' own imperial projects in Iraq, Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, Afghanistan, massacres of thousands of defenseless innocents are labeled wars. Resistance is called a provocation, terrorism, or a crime against humanity. The rule of law, as well as respect for most basic civil liberties and the right of self-determination, is a public relations fiction used to placate the consciousness of those who live in the zones of privilege. Prisoners are routinely tortured and disappeared. The severance of the issue is shown by the lack of food and medical supplies, but this is accepted as a tactic of control. Lies permeate the airwaves. Religious and racial and ethnic groups are demonized. Missiles rain down on concrete hovels. Mechanized units fire on unarmed villagers. Gunboats pound refugee camps with heavy shells, and the dead, including children, line the corridors of hospitals that lack electricity and medicine. The impending collapse of the international economy, the assaults on our climate, the resulting droughts, floods, precipitous decline in crop yields, the rising food prices, all are creating a universe where power is divided between the narrow elites who hold in their hands sophisticated instruments of death and the enraged masses. The crises are fostering a class war that will dwarf anything previously. They are establishing a world where most will be hungry and live in fear, while a few will gorge themselves on delicacies and protected compounds. And more people will have to be sacrificed to keep this imbalance in place. Because it was the power to do so, Israel, as does the United States, flouts international law to keep a subject population in misery. The continued presence of Israeli occupation forces defies nearly 100 UN resolutions from the UN Security Council. They want Israel to withdraw. Israel says no. The Israeli blockade of Gaza, established in June 2007, is a brutal form of collective punishment that violates Article 33 of the 4th 1949 Geneva Convention, which set up rules for the protection of civilian personnel in time of war. the blockade has turned Gaza into a sliver of hell, an Israeli-administered ghetto where thousands have died, including 1,400 civilians in the Israeli incursion of 2008. With 95% of its factories shut down, Palestinian industry has virtually ceased functioning. The remaining 5% operate at 25% capacity. Even the fishing industry is moribund. Israeli forces refuse to let fishermen travel more than 3 miles from the coastline, and within the fishing zone, boats frequently come under Israeli fire. The Israeli border patrols have seized 35% of the agricultural land in Gaza for a buffer zone. The collapsing infrastructure and Israeli seizure of aquifers means that many refugee camps, such as Khan Yunis, there is no running water. The United Nations Relief and Work Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the Near East estimates that 80% of all Gazans now rely upon food aid. And the claim of Israeli self-defense belies the fact that it is Israel that maintains an illegal occupation and violates international law by carrying out collective punishment of Palestinians. It is Israel that chooses to escalate the violence when, during an incursion in Gaza earlier this month, its forces fatally shot a 13-year-old boy. As the world breaks down, this becomes the new paradigm. Modern warlords awash in terrifying technologies and weapons, murdering whole peoples. We do the same in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. Market forces and the military mechanisms that protect these forces are the sole ideology that governs industrial states and humans' relationship to the natural world. It is an ideology that results in millions of dead and millions more displaced from their homes in the developing world. And the awful algebra of this ideology means that these forces will eventually be unleashed on us. You heard me correct. On we, the people of the United States. Those who cannot be of use to market forces are considered expendable. They have no rights and legitimacy. Their existence, whether in Gaza or blighted post-industrial cities in Camden, New Jersey, are considered a drain on efficiency and progress. They are viewed as refuge, and as refuge, they do not have a voice or freedom. They can be and are extinguished and imprisoned at will. This is the world where only corporate power and profit are sacred. It is a world of barbarism. In conclusion, there are 47.1 million Americans who depend upon food stamps to eat. The elites are plotting to take these food stamps away, along with other entitlements that keep the poor from destitution. The slashing of trillions of dollars from Medicare, Medicaid, and other social programs, given the political impasse in Washington and the looming fiscal cliff, now seems certain. There are 50 million people considered to be living below the poverty level in the United States because the poverty level is so low, $22,000 for a family of four. This figure means nothing. Add the tens of millions of Americans who live in a category called near poverty, including all those families attempting to live on less than $45,000 a year per family, and you have at least one-third of the entire American population living in poverty. 100 million people, and all we have in return are promises to be broken and lies. Once these people figure out that there is no economic recovery, that there is their standard of living is going to continue to drop, that they are trapped, that hope in the future is an illusion, they will become as angry as the protesters I've been discussing about in Greece and Spain, or the militants in Gaza or Afghanistan. Banks and other financial corporations handed trillions in interest-free money from the Federal Reserve. Meanwhile, they hoarded $5 trillion, much of it looted from the U.S. Treasury. The longer this worldwide disparity and inequality is perpetrated, the more the masses will revolt, and the faster we will internally replicate the Israeli model of domestic control. Drones overhead, all dissent criminalized, SWAT teams busting through your doors, deadly force is an acceptable form of adjudication, food uses a weapon, and constant surveillance. Commentary from Chris Hedges from TruthDig.com. Back in a moment with your response. Talkback is next. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888.
He came from... She musters a smile for his nostalgic tale. Never coming near what he wanted to say.
Nice to have you with us. I'm looking at the phone board right now. Interesting. We're just starting to get our phones. Kind of thing you have to think about for a moment, and I certainly understand that. Now all the phone lines are starting to light up, and we'll get your phone calls up as soon as possible. We will extend this, even though for almost all of our land-based stations, in 55 minutes, which is about 3 minutes now, we'll say goodbye, but you can continue to listen to the comments from people in the audience by dialing the phone number 832-280-0066 or simply going to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Let us say hello to Jeff from New Jersey. Hi, Jeff, your turn. Jeff, you're on.
Hi, Gary. I don't have much time to talk because I'm actually at work right now, but I hope when you go into your dissertation about the spy complex we have right now is the satellites, the hundreds of satellites that are now being used to spy on us regularly. And there was a man who wrote a whistleblower book who wrote a book about satellites and how they're utilized to spy on us on a regular basis and trying to attempt to read our minds, believe it or not.
Well, in the program I'm doing this evening at 7 p.m., we have one expert just talking about what the satellites do, what can they do, and why they're doing it, and who gets that information on us. I'm going to handle that. Thank you. Ray from Hicksville. Hi, Ray.
Ray, how are you doing?
Good.
I was listening to your explanation of the conflict in the Middle East, and it's all well and good, but the part of the equation I think that you left out was the constant barrage of rockets into Israel. I think that creates a problem also.
Okay.
And hard feelings, at least on one side.
I agree. I believe that what Hamas does is wrong, and there are radicalized factions and possibly some that are not only radicalized but are there to are provocateurs that stimulate that. But look at it this way. Hamas shows up at a fight with a slingshot. Israel shows up with a flamethrower. Wonder who's going to win that. You don't see in the American media all the children and innocents who have been killed thus far, which is now at 100. But we keep hearing about the three Israelis who died. I'm opposed to anyone dying. I want to see a peaceful resolution to this. I do not see any mechanism of this. And yet when they were showing just a few kilometers away from Gaza, they were showing daily life, outdoor cafes, beautiful streets, modern buildings, people strolling at the beach playing soccer. Now, when was the last time you or anyone else chose to get an idea of what it's like to live for 24 hours in Gaza? There are none of those cafes or clean streets or beautiful suburbs or safe neighborhoods or beaches where people can frolic and have a good time or knowing you can drink a glass of water. So you have to pull back and stay objective and stay neutral and just look at that. Now, all of us who have any notion of history would be appalled and are appalled at what the Germans put the Jews through in the Warsaw ghettos and Krakow and other places. Those individuals who were able to survive did so because of enormous ingenuity and strength of character. Show me what it means, then, for the people who have suffered to look at people who are suffering. This is a comment that was from a professor, Jeremy Salt. Quote, a message to the brave Israeli airmen. What is it like firing missiles at people you cannot see? Are you unable to do this if you could see them? Is your conscience eased by inflicting disproportionate force on people unable to fight back and civilian infrastructure? Are you comfortable about slaughtering civilian women, men, and children and infants? Does this weigh on your conscience, or does it put you at ease? Do you sleep well or have nightmares about men, women, and children you have killed at home, in beds, kitchens, living rooms, schools, mosques, at work, or at play? Do farmers in their fields, mothers with children, teachers in classrooms, children at play, the elderly, frail, or disabled, threaten your security? Do you ever question what you've done and why? Have you shame or decency? Do you have an idea of the difference between right and wrong? Do you know the law? If so, why do you violate it? Doing so makes you complicit in crimes of war and against humanity. Do you know that? Do you blindly follow orders, or do you have a mind of your own? Have you murdered civilians before? Will you do it again if ordered? Will you keep following orders blindly or do the right thing? Palestinian suffering is a way of life. Imagine living every day, not sure if you'll live or die. Imagine young children growing up this way. Do Israeli children know that what Palestinians' children endure? Are they told? Do they care? Do their parents? So I believe that before we say, well, gee whiz, it's bad to have the missiles firing into Israel, it is. I agree. Why can't we show the full context in which this conflict is existing? Why can't we show an entire imprisoned society where you cannot just walk out? You can't get out, even if you need an emergency operation. We're 12 hours a day if go without power. What do you think the world's opinion would be if it were reversed? And I think that is what we must keep in our mind so our ideologies do not imbalance us. Let us speak with Chris from Queens. Hi, Chris. Chris, you're on the air.
Three very quick points I'd like to ask you to address. And let me just first start by saying that there's absolutely no excuse. I don't care whether you're Palestinian, green, brown, Jewish, or whatever, for any missile to come raining on you when you're sitting at a cafe or in the backyard of your home, okay? And that includes everybody. It's not just for Israelis. It's also for Palestinians.
We would agree with that.
I have a couple of very quick questions because this is never addressed. You mentioned earlier, and I heard this morning, because no one is talking about the timeline here, that this 13-year-old boy was shot, which is what I think actually initiated this particular incursion, because it's the way it's reported, it's sort of just taken out of the air, and I'm not really sure who actually started this. My second point is two other very quick points, if you will allow me. I'll be very brief. I have asked this question in the past, and I've never gotten an answer. The Gaza Strip is not part of Israel. Now, the Israelis might want to take the whole place over, but the point is that the international community does not recognize it as such. And I want to know why Israel has the jurisdiction, I'm not sure how else to call it, to administer, okay, this territory when this territory does not belong to them. And I mean, it is an officially occupied land. It has no international status, okay? And so I want to know why the United Nations and all of these other the modern Europeans who are turning into present-day fascists, the ones that are ruling there now, not the people. I want to know why this is not addressed. I want to know why they have a right to go forward with these military, totally lopsided incursions without, you know, addressing it. I mean, there should be international peacekeepers there. There should be something overseeing this territory until it does, if it ever does, reach its own autonomous state. And one last other point I'd like to make. These buildings, if you go back to 209, when they killed like something 1,400 civilians when they used that white phosphorus. I'll never forget those pictures. I want to know a lot of the aid, because I know that the United States also at least did, I assume they still do, they send aid money to Palestine. And this money was used in the past to build schools and libraries and other such things. And my question to you is, this actually comes from, I'm assuming, American taxpayer money. Now, when you have Israel going in there and destroying buildings that are clearly not military buildings, I mean, they can whistle to high heaven that there are militants in there, but that's a war crime, okay? When there are children in there and innocent people and journalists, you don't bomb buildings. These are not military sites. So my question to you is, why is it acceptable that we send they don't get billions, but they get in the high millions, aid to Palestine and all of these facilities that our tax dollars paid for, and they are destroyed, and no one addresses this.
So, Sylvia, you've raised many important and legitimate concerns, and I thank you for calling in and sharing that. I cannot tell what's in the mind of European leaders or even the Arab League leaders, because you have a few, only a handful of Sunni-controlled nations, and almost always in some conflict with the Shia-based nations, and that's why there's never unanimity, and yet you must have a unanimous decision by the Arab League before it goes forward. That's why they have done so little in the past. Individual nations or the rulers may choose to do something, but as a group they can't and won't. To your issue, which is, I think, very germane, who gave Israel the right to completely surround this and to put up the walls and the barriers, and you can't go in, you can't go out, a ship can't come in. And they actually measure the amount of calories that a person can eat so that they're just barely able to stay alive, and that's how much they allow in instead of all the trucks that should come in. That's because Israel, like the United States, deems that whatever it chooses to do, since it's in the position of power, it will do. The very argument Barack Obama said this morning, I can't imagine, you know, anyone standing by when rockets are coming into a person's, you know, a country from an outside source and puts their citizens at risk. That's correct. You and I are both the same. As I've said, I'm absolutely opposed to any form of terrorist activity, including the stupidity of firing these. If anything, it's probably just some stupid effort. But it's not going to mean anything militarily. It can keep the people fearful. It will possibly injure or kill some, as it has. You're not going to defeat Israel that way. Then I said, well, why won't you hold the same standards when Pakistan says officially, as a government, don't send drones into our country, and we do so. And Afghanistan and other countries don't send drones, and we do so. So since we don't seem to respect the sovereignty of any other nation in the world, and we build bases around other nations, and we do what we want to do, then why shouldn't Israel, since it's a leading ally? My problem with all this is that the American media, the American journalist in total, the American legislators have not given equal opportunity to spend time in fact-finding in the occupied territories, to actually go there and learn what it's like to be there and how this goes on, and then come back and make a decision. It's always one-sided, and that kind of imbalance cannot offer solutions. I thank you very much, Sylvia, for the questions you've raised, except you and I cannot answer them. I'm Gary Knoll. I thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing tonight on our program, Progressive Commentary, where we take on the military-industrial intelligence state and why they feel they have a right to read our mail and listen to our emails and our phone calls and text messages, with all done illegally, and why we are allowing that. Have a nice day.